Thus far in our venture into the book of Job, we have sat back and watched as the extreme suffering of Job was permitted in the heavens and carried out on the earth. Job 1 and 2 have introduced us to Job's no doubt immense and deep suffering. And once his friends heard of it, they came from afar to him, didn't recognize him, but once they knew it was him, they sat in silence for 7 days. The initial narrative of Job is now behind us. And notice that as the last chapter of verse, the last verse of chapter 2 comes to us, chapter 2 ends in silence. And notice as verse 1 in chapter 3 begins, it is not his friends who break the silence. It is Job himself who breaks the silence. And in so doing, Job begins the middle portion of the book that so many do not know what to do with. It is poetry, and it is dark. We could call it a lament. Verse 1 and 2 in chapter 3 begin it like this. The narrator says, "After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said." We can call what follows a lament because it truly is a lament. Job is mourning and grieving all the suffering that's come upon him. Yet by the way he forms this lament, we can call it more than a lament. We can call it a protest because Job is not only suffering, he's angry because he's suffering. And he wants to know the answer to one question. What do you think the question is? Why? Why is the question? Job here in this chapter is not addressing his friends. He's not even addressing God. He's just talking out of his grief and sorrow. And so Job is as a teapot reaching the boiling point. Job is exploding and bursting forth from his deep grief. And it's as if Job is trying to bring his faith and his experience together into something that makes sense to him in this present suffering. By talking the way he does in chapter 3, we get a window into his heart. We need to remember two things. When Job utters these words in chapter 3, he's not alone. His friends hear these words. As chapter 4 begins, and the very first response to Job comes from Eliphaz the Temanite. And as the other friends begin to chime in their order, we learn that they, though they heard his words in chapter 3, they did not hear his heart in chapter 3. But we must not forget that God, though he seems dark and shrouded at the present moment for Job, God is hearing the words in Job chapter 3 as well. And so, even in the darkness, there is a ray, small though it may be, of hope. Job chapter 3 can be divided into 2 sections. Most people do 3. I feel after examining this text, 2 are sufficient. We'll work through them one at a time. A lament in verse 3 to 10, and then the protest comes in verse 11 to 26. The lament, verse 3 to 10, the protest in verse 11 to 26. Let's look at verse 3 to 10. "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said, 'A man is conceived.' Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none. nor see the eyelids of the morning, because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. In the first two chapters of Job, we see two specific days in view. The day in chapter 1, when the Lord permitted the greatness of Job to be taken away as all his possessions are stripped from him. And in the day in chapter 2 is the next one, when we see the person of Job attacked with all the boils from head to toe. As he begins, specifically in verse 4 and 5, we see Job himself bring up two more days, or perhaps a day and an evening, in view. Specifically, the day of his birth and the night that he was conceived. Satan and Job's wife have tried to get Job to curse God, and here Job is cursing. He is cursing, but God is not the object of his curses. His birthday is the object. In light of his current state, Job in verse 3 looks back and curses this day and wishes that he had never been born. He now wishes that the sun had never risen that day and darkness would have reigned instead of light. When Job wishes that the gloom and deep darkness would claim this day, the Hebrew word for claim there is the Hebrew word redeem. So it's an interesting, ironic twist. It's a reversal of creation and redemption when God speaks into and redeems darkness with his light. Job wishes the opposite would have happened for the day of his birth and the night he was conceived, that darkness would have claimed or redeemed that day so that no light would have ever risen on the horizon. In essence, Job is now in so much pain that he wishes God would hit the rewind button on his life and just let it go. Hit rewind and walk away. Usually, birthdays are a celebration of life. They're a celebration of maturity, further maturity and progression into more years that the Lord has given us under the sun. But Job doesn't wish to have another birthday. In verse 6, he goes even further back to speak of the night he was conceived, wanting it to be stripped of all of its happiness and wiped off the calendar. In verse 7, he yearns for the joyful cry of his parents' intimacy would be filled with barrenness rather than fertility. And perhaps some of you Tolkien fans think of when you hear of the Leviathan being roused from the deep, you think of that moment when the Fellowship of the Ring enters the minds of Moria, and it's Pippin in the deathly quiet who touches the skeleton that falls down the well, that makes a racket, that awakens the what? The Balrog. And then stands back in terror as it unleashes its fury and takes Gandalf from them. In a similar way, in verse 8, Job wishes that someone or something powerful enough who has the ability to curse would curse this day, letting loose the Leviathan on it, so destruction and chaos would have their way. And as we read verse 9 and 10, that his wish is for there to be no stars, no light, no hope, no sight, and no open door for birth, we see that Job, in looking back, wants that night that he was conceived to be a night that never ends with dawn. There's no day at the end of this night, and Job wishes it would have been so. After seeing these first this first lament in verse 3 to 10, we as the readers must recognize something. All his lamenting is but a fantasy. None of these things can happen. The past is the past, and he cannot in the present go back and change any of these things. He cannot change what has already occurred. And so this poetic lament is powerful, not because his desires will happen, but because his desires and his words show us the nature of his heart. His present is so dark that he cannot see any light in the future. And he wishes that he never had a past to begin with. Or to say it another way, like he does in verse 10, Job wishes that he had never been born because it was his birth that launched him out into the world that he would experience this great suffering in. And so because of that, the present suffering, he goes all the way back. And he says, I wish none of it had ever happened. That's his lament. His inner angst is now becoming audible for those around him and for the Lord to hear as well. But as we get to verse 11, the lament seems to turn up a notch. And it's no longer lamenting, it's protesting. That's what we see in verse 11 to 26. There's a clear shift in language. He began expressing desires, desires that won't ever come to pass, and that these desires won't ever come to pass, and that Job knows that this is an exercise in futility, wanting these things to be. He then starts asking questions, five of them in particular, and there's one word that's common to all five questions. Why? Why? Question one is in verse 11. Why did I not die at birth, come out from the womb and expire? Question 2, verse 12 to 15. Why did the knees receive me? Or why the breasts that I should nurse? For then I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept. Then I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves. Or with princes who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Question 3, verse 16 to 19. Why was I not hidden as a stillborn child, as infants who never see the light? There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. There the prisoners are at ease together. They hear not the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Question 4, verse 20 and 22. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death, but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave? And then question 5, verse 23, why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? Moving from the womb to the knees to the breasts to nurse is usually a pattern of health and loving nurture that children follow and grow up in maturity as they're sustained in life. But for Job, that same pattern did not usher him out into a blissful existence, but entered him into a world, entered him into an ocean where the waves were too high and too stormy for him to stay afloat. These things fill out the first three questions of his protest, and each time the answer seems to be that while life is now horror and misery to him, death would be something of rest and peace to him. While some, notice, perhaps some of you very detailed thinkers in here, well, some of you could develop a very strange doctrine of the afterlife from these verses. Specifically, look at verse 17 and 18. Death, somehow, with these big kings and princes who collect gold for themselves, who rebuild ruins, even the wicked, death is something where they cease from trouble and they're at rest and peace, rather than how we would want to define it biblically, as the wicked go into eternal torment. to define a whole doctrine of afterlife from this passage alone is to ask a question of this text that the text itself does not intend to answer. So don't ask, basically. This is not what's going on. But then we have a new question, don't we? What is going on? And I think that Job, if we're all honest, is describing normal life. Job is describing normal life. In the evening, the pattern is we lay down and we rest and we are quiet and we are at peace. This is what Job wants most. But Job's daytime is nothing but a terror. And so he wants the rest and peace of night. Or switch the analogy around a bit and perhaps see it like this. There are times of suffering that we can experience that is so deep in this life that the nightmare of the day is escaped from by sleeping in the evening. This is what Job has in view. He wants to escape from the nightmare of the day by having peaceful sleep. I don't think when we reach verse 20 that there's enough to merit another point or another transition in the text. It's still the same form of protest. This is where most commentators, most pastors arrive at point three. And I think that's simply because we have gotten into a ridiculous routine where every sermon has to be 3 points. And so this just is the place to get the third point. We have 2 points in this text, and it continues the protest, though, in there, speaking on their side, the protest that is very personal up into verse 20, in verse 20, gets global. He starts asking questions that are big, that all of life, all of mankind are in view. An irony is in view when he starts getting global with his questions. Why are those who want death, why do those who want death, why are they unable to find it? Usually, when we talk about treasure hunting, we have images of Indiana Jones, the dwarves of Tolkien's world, etc., etc. It's something that's exciting. It's something that we hear the soundtrack of the Pirates of the Caribbean when they're going to X marks the spot. But notice how Job uses the analogy here. The striking thing about this struggle is that Job likens it as a treasure hunt. For those who long for death and they dig for it more than hidden treasure, why can they not find it? It's as if the X on the map keeps moving for these individuals, and they cannot simply get there. For Job, suffering is so deep that only death would give him peace. That's what's in view. Then, in the last question, in verse 23, Job brings up what we've seen now every night we've been in Job. We've talked about that ridiculous prayer request, a hedge of protection. Job brings up this hedge of protection in verse 23, but he twists it around. We saw earlier in chapter 1, verse 10, that Satan's complaint to God was that God had hedged Job in. He had hedged him in so that no lack or pain would ever come his way. Now Job turns this on his head and says it's that protective hedge. It feels like a prison to him now. The gates and the bars of suffering now form a hedge around him that he cannot escape of, regardless of how many keys to it he sticks in that hole. This cage doesn't feel safe. It rather makes him feel like he's inside a cell of suffering, and God is the one who has thrown the key away. Because of all these things, verse 24 and 26 form something of a climactic final protest and lament. For my sighing comes instead of bread, and my groanings are poured out like water. For the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes. So Job's daily diet is not water or bread or ease or quiet. It's sighing, groaning, fear, and dread. Because Job has been unable to answer the question why, the chapter ends, continuing in his trouble. There is no happy ending to chapter 3. If this is a movie, it's one of the movies where the bad guys win at the end, and we feel completely unsatisfied watching it. It's why they're so rare, but why when you see one, you tend to remember them. Because moments like this are hard to forget. And so I just have a question that I was asking at the end that our commentary, Christopher Ashe, our guide through Job, he asks. He says, what are we to make of this chapter? Where is gospel in this chapter? We can conclude from this, Ash says, that in the midst of our suffering, language like this, we often conclude that it's inappropriate, sinful, uncalled for. This would be a wrong conclusion for us to reach. Not only because we find similar vocabulary given to us by God all over the rest of the scripture, but because here in Job, we must remember that God has already spoken of Job's quality. And we must not forget this, that Job isn't suffering because of his sin, but ironically, he is now suffering so deeply because he's a godly man. And that's why he was singled out for these things. And after all the poetic back and forth of Job and his friends, God again reminds us that Job has not sinned with his lips. Therefore, the only conclusion that we can rightly come to about Job in Job chapter 3 is that sometimes those who walk with God walk in this world as sailors in the midst of people who don't believe in an ocean. And we feel utterly alone and isolated. To Job, the only solution to this suffering is death. It's the only solution. For those of you with a philosophy interest or background, you may recognize some similar themes into the philosopher more modern than historic Albert Camus. Has anybody ever heard of him? Camus? Henry? That's it? Camus is very depressing to read. He's in our library too. But he writes a book called The Myth of Sisyphus, and he uses this myth and creates a whole book upon it, really getting at one question. Because life is so horrible, and because there's no meaning in it, the only possible question that mankind can ever answer correctly is, why should we not end it ourselves? This is Job chapter 3, language. C.S. Lewis explains how this was true for him after his wife died. He said this in the book A Grief Observed. This is one of the disquieting symptoms. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing God, if you remember yourself and turn to God with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to Him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face, and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. And after that, silence. You may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become. There are no lights in the windows. It might well as be an empty house. Was it ever inhabited? It seemed so once. Christians, very godly individuals, can have seasons of life or entire lives like Job chapter 3. When we see others in seasons like this, we would not serve them well if we made them feel as if the reason they were in such seasons is because of their sin. What did you do to cause such pain in your own soul? Surely you must have done something. We could go on and on and on about those who struggle like this in history and found hope, found gospel hope in the midst of their own suffering by remembering the deeper and darker suffering of Christ that innocent Job points us to and brings us such rich gospel hope. But I fear we'd go on forever, so perhaps we can save that for the Q&A time. We can give one or two examples. So let me just end by saying this. Job 3 is dark. It's dark for sure. But even in Job's protest, notice that there's a ray of light, that there's a ray of hope. All throughout this chapter, we see Job energized. He is speaking, and he is speaking vehemently with God about why these things are going on. Verse 20 indicates that he's dealing with God, I think, when it says that he's the one who gives light or life to men. Think also of chapter 1, 20, verse 22. He gives, he takes away. Job knows this. So when suffering hits them, he thinks, God's the one who's brought this to me. Therefore, I will deal with this with God rather than away from God. Which really is the root solution to everyone who's in a season of darkness. Darkness is okay, but it's not okay to go through the darkness apart from God. You go with it through him. Anger is okay. You do not go through anger alone. You go through it with God. The questions go to him. And so Psalm 13 becomes your vocabulary. Why? 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 This shows us here that even Job, in the midst of his struggle, he wants to struggle with God rather than without him. And that ought to give us hope and leave us an example in our own suffering. Such is Job chapter 3.